Vodka O'Clock.
Hey everyone, it's Amber Love, and welcome to the year-end wrap-up at Vodka O'Clock. Joining me today, we're going to actually have several special guests, and first up is Dennis Tafoya, who's been one of my Twitter friends, like, forever, and we finally, like, run into each other in Philadelphia now and again. So, hey, welcome to the show, finally.
Thanks very much, Amber. It's really cool to be here.
So, I know you because of this sort of unofficial Algonquin roundtable that we've got down there in Philly with all of the writers and all the noir people, the fans and stuff. So you are here. We're going to talk about your favorite books and your favorite movies and music and other things that come up. And it should be pretty interesting because I know that we know some of the same people and some of the same writers, but chances are I have not read any of the books that you're going to bring up. So it'll add to my list. So let's get a little bit of your background. Where are you from? What's going on? Why are you here?
Okay. I'm a Philadelphia area writer. I currently live in Lambertville, New Jersey, but grew up in, born in Philadelphia, grew up in the suburbs of Philly mostly. And I have been writing crime fiction for Minotaur, and which is where our mutual friend Dwayne Swarzynski started. And I have two books out, Dope Thief and The Wolves of Fairmount Park. And I have a third coming out, which, if the gods smile on me, will be the beginning of a series. The book's called The Poor Boy's Game. And it's about a woman who is an ex-fighter and an ex-federal marshal who ends up having to protect somebody against her own father, who's a career criminal. So the fun of those really is getting to spend time with Philly history. That's the stuff that I really enjoy, Philly culture, which is, one of the things I really love about the city is the really cool, interesting, and unique approach to the arts that we have.
And I know, one of the things that I talked to Dwayne about and is about how the city itself or any environment, depending on what you choose, really becomes such a character in a book. And, you know, we talk about David Goodis a lot because they do the Goodis tour down there. Yep. And, Philly is, one of the legendary cities of our country. So obviously it's got a lot to go back over when you're doing this. So what time period are you setting your story?
Well, it's today. It takes place now. I played around a little bit with some of the history stuff. The book, the kind of fictional departure was for the Roofers Union scandals, which not too many folks remember anymore. But back in the mid 80s, there was a family that dominated the Roofers Union Local 3032, who were linked up with the Scarfo mob. And, there were a lot of investigations and judges were investigated at the time. It was a big crime story in the context of a larger crime story, which was the Scarfo mob and the sort of dissolution of the old Philly mob. But I sort of kind of updated that a bit and brought it, forward into the present day. One of the things, too, that I really enjoyed playing with were a couple of interesting bits of Philly culture, the Toynbee tiles. And I don't know if you are familiar with the Toynbee tiles in Philly.
No, I don't know what that is.
It's a really cool thing. It started in Philadelphia, went all over the world, and it was these odd tiles that were set into streets all over the city and then showed up in New York and Chicago and other cities, eventually down in South America. And there was a fantastic documentary that came out a couple of years ago called Resurrect Dead, which is from the frequently quoted, frequently used passage in these tiles, which are all, they use, almost all of them say, resurrect dead on planet Jupiter, a Toynbee idea. Which references this guy Toynbee and this idea that a physicist named Toynbee, and the idea that eventually everybody who had ever been alive on Earth would be resurrected on the planet Jupiter. It's this crazy story, but the documentary is incredible. It's kind of beautiful, and these guys who were doing it, I think, solved the mystery of who was doing these tiles. So that was something that was really stuck in my head, and I make references to that, and then also Zoe Strauss. Zoe Strauss is a Philly photographer that I really love. Her work appeared for a year on billboards all over Philadelphia. And then she kind of, you know, kind of blew up as an artist and had a showing of her work at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, and is actually right now at the International Center for Photography in New York City. So those are cool things that, you know, not just the sort of dark history of Philadelphia and the criminal history of Philadelphia, but that are neat things about the city that I really love to reference when I'm writing.
That's so cool. I know that one of the things that happens, well, at least when I'm writing, is I get so stuck in the research that I procrastinate the writing part. And it's like, well, no, I really, really need to look up what the furniture looks like from, you know, 1876, because I need to see what shape the teacups were. No, you really don't.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. It's so much more. Research is so much fun. And I mean, I really do think, you know, I do a ton of research, and it's kind of funny because you know, in a sense, there's not that much to know about the things that I'm playing with. You know, it's contemporary Philadelphia. You know, if you live in the world, you know probably enough about crime to write the kind of books that I write. But I do find all these cool and incredible things when I'm doing research, and I'm always looking for that crazy little detail. And that's usually where I try to make myself stop, when I find that one little thing. But one of the things that happened to me when I was working on Poor Boy's Game was I had an idea. I wanted to use boxing. I wanted the woman, the protagonist, to be an ex-fighter, and her father to be an ex-fighter. And what I found out, and it's kind of one of those weird things where you imagine something and it turns out to be true. It turned out that the guys who were running the Roofers Union really did recruit guys out of the boxing gyms in Philly and turn them into bruisers, turn them into thugs who would, you know, beat people for, you know, for working without cards, or, you know, guys for contractors who were trying to get over and not use union help. So that, wow, that's a really cool thing. That was a friend of mine, Greg Gillespie, who runs Port Richmond Books. Greg had told me about that. It was like, my God, that's such a cool little detail. And that's the kind of stuff that you love to find, but you don't want to just keep going and going and going until the year is gone and you haven't, you know, written what you needed to write. So
exactly. Port Richmond's a great store too. It's just, you can get really lost in there.
Oh, man. Yeah.
It's so much fun. So let's talk about what some of your favorite books that you read and or listened to, because I know you're a big audiobook fan too. I'm also in the car way too much, so I have a list of audiobooks that I've gone through. It's surprising me that you are so crazy about horror, because I know that, you know, you're a crime guy, and I guess they can bleed into each other pretty well, especially when you get into like supernatural detective stories. But I don't know what precise horror it is that you've latched onto.
You know, I tend to like stuff that exists in the mostly recognizable world that brings some odd element into it. And one of the books I read this year that was not a new book is the book Come Closer by Sarah Gran. And that's a story that Sarah wrote about a woman who basically becomes possessed or goes insane. And of course, it's not clear, and certainly not clear to anybody around her, which is the case. So it's more of that, I would say more in the fantasy realm, but more in the sort of straight up urban, recognizable environment, people undergoing a crisis, and the crisis happens to be some horrific or demonic element. That's the stuff that I think I really love. I also read another book, once again, not new, but a fantastic book, a Kelly Link collection of stories called Stranger Things Happen. And Kelly Link is amazing, amazing writer. I really recommend both Sarah. Sarah has a number of books recently, both the Claire DeWitt series that she's in the middle of now, that I think is actually being developed for television, which would be pretty cool. Sarah worked as a writer on the Southland series, the TV show.
Cop Show?
Yeah, exactly, the Cop Show. And so the same folks are in development, I believe, on a series based on her Claire DeWitt novels, which are, once again, the sort of selling them a little bit short. It's called like Psychic Detectives. It's the main character has psychic gifts that she uses in in the detection of crime. But the Kelly Link stories are really all over the map. Some of them are really far out sort of horror. Some of them are just the wonderful kind of feeling of the uncanny, where you don't know exactly what's going on even in the story. All written from the point of view of somebody who's dead, or some traveler lost in this strange land, that kind of thing. But they're all beautifully written, really amazing stories. So those are kind of some of the older stuff that I read. Some of the stuff from this year, written by people that they're friends of mine who are amazing writers. Wallace Strobe, and I don't know if you've ever met Wallace.
I haven't met him yet, no. But also on the Twitter, so.
Yeah, and he's a great guy, and he just had his third book in a series of Chrissa Stone novels. And Chrissa Stone is a woman who is an armed robber, who does sort of high-end armed robbery. And the stories are just really fantastic examples of a really tightly wired, very realistic, crime where it's all sort of very stripped down. You don't get a lot of interior monologue. You get, the events as they unfold, which is, I find, really affecting, because those little cracks that you get where you see her history and her relationship to the world. In the latest one, she ends up having to protect a woman and her child. And so you get to see, and largely without going into much detail, the loss in her life of family and connection. And so it's, really amazing, getting great reviews, showing up on a lot of the best of the year lists, and just fantastic stuff. And then Megan Abbott, who is also a good friend of mine, Megan wrote a couple of books. Dare Me being her sort of, I think, like a breakout for her. Dare Me is less traditional crime, and sort of opened up this world where it's people are describing it as Bring It On, the cheerleader story, meets Richard the Third, because it's sort of the machinations behind the scenes, a darkness of a cheerleading squad, which is really, can sound very kind of lightweight, but is very dark. And
if I'm not mistaken, she tweets about cheerleading a lot.
Yes, she does, right? Yeah, and that was, once again, came out of all the cheerleading research she did. I think she made a lot of great friends and learned a lot, and now sort of that's part of her stream, of things that she'll Twitter about. Megan's a real role model for me in terms of her social media presence, especially because she is always finding the most interesting, cool stuff. And we have a shared passion, which is true crime, that we get together and very unhealthily geek out about.
I can imagine that happening. I mean, it's, and then the reality has to hit you, like, okay, but this really did happen, but it's fascinating, There's so many shows about it too that you have to. I guess there's a little like dehumanization that goes on as to separate yourselves from the fact that like these were real victims here.
Yeah, that's always the time, and it's really interesting, isn't it? It's you do, and one of my friends, Hillary Davidson, is another fantastic crime writer, and Hillary did a post on a blog the other day about that, about sort of the difficulty, I think, of, we all write about crime. You want it to be real enough to evoke that sense of consequences, but you want to do it with some empathy, and you want to do it with some, humanity, because otherwise it's just kind of awful, and, you feel less for having read it, rather than something where you can, once again, have a sense of consequences, have a sense that something that you're reading matters, but it's not, just cartoonish or, in the old bad sense, that it brings some subtlety and understanding and empathy to the people involved. To me, there's like nothing more fun, nothing more demanding than writing about people who are awful in a lot of ways, but to make some claim on your humanity, to put those people across as people that you can recognize and have some connection with.
And what's I find interesting is how there's really no delineation at that point, whether something is a crime story or a horror story,
right?
Because these people, you know, can be truly horrific. And, you know, the things that happened, like those three women that were kidnapped in Ohio and held in that house for, you know, 12 years.
Yes, my God.
The things that happened, that man was truly a monster, and they were real people. So it's not horror, it's not fiction, it's, you know, it was a real thing, but yet it's, to me, that's that sort of gray area of, you know, where would you shelve this story if you were writing it from a fiction perspective?
I thought many times, actually, it's a story I've wanted to write for years about a woman who's kidnapped and held for, a period of time in a way that the kidnapper thinks is permanent, you know, that he's done this before. I just can't bring myself to do it because I'm so repulsed by victimization of that kind, ongoing, you know, sort of sustained degradation and humiliation. I find that really hard to stay with. And I'm sure there's a way, and somebody smarter than I am can figure out how to do that. And obviously, I think it would be about focusing on the resilience and endless sort of creativity of the people who are victims in that situation. How do you stay a human being? How do you stay alive and of value, in a sense, right, for somebody like that? And the real intelligence you would have to bring, emotional intelligence, to survive that experience for a prolonged period of time, I can't imagine what that takes. And I think that would be probably the way into that story, would be to focus on that, you know, without sensationalizing the horror of it, you know?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting way to approach it.
Like I said, it's something I think about a lot because, you know, the people who really interest me are people who are really damaged. And also, like you say, blurring the line between people who are just folks, you know, and who have these very sort of dangerous parts to themselves. In writing the new novel, I knew there was no way I was going to write somebody who was like a straight up hero. I don't understand folks like that. So I knew it was going to be somebody who was very flawed, who had their own difficulties and issues, who came from a family that was incredibly, you know, compromised. And that's my way into all that stuff. It's like, once I know what your problem is, I think I can write you, you know?
Well, it's interesting because in the comics world, a lot of people complain that Superman is boring.
Right.
Because of that. And yet he is, you know, truly the most iconic superhero, I think, of all time.
Right.
You know, like he's that recognizable. And even though he's been written where he's not perfect and, you know, terrible things have happened, but we don't think of those things because it's not as much of his character as some of the other characters that are out there. But you had mentioned Laird Barron. Now tell me about those stories that you got into.
Oh yeah. Like I said, I kind of ran across him and, listening to an audio book that was a collection of science fiction and paranormal stories. And my youngest daughter, who is also a writer, who writes YA urban fantasy, gave me a book called The Beautiful Thing That Awaits Us All, which I'm just a couple stories into, but is pretty fantastic. He also shows up in the collection I just read, which was basically the best horror of the year, a collection edited by Ellen Datlow that also contains another a friend of ours, Dwayne Straczynski, who wrote one of the stories. And Laird Barron is a fascinating guy because he plays with sort of two streams a lot. One is 20th century American Cold War history, espionage and things like that. One of the stories centered on the remote viewing program of the CIA, which is a crazy story in and of itself where they got.
It is. I love it. I think it's fascinating.
Yeah. You know, they tried to put people in a room and see if they could conjure where Soviet subs were and where Soviet missile bases were. It's kind of, you know, one of those areas where our tax dollars went really crazy, you know, followed the CIA down some pretty crazy rabbit holes. And then, so he takes that stream, and then he's got this obvious, very deep knowledge of folklore from all over the world, going back hundreds of years, thousands of years, and connecting that, you know, with monsters, werewolves, you know, different demons from different cultures, and tapping into both of these very interesting strains. So he gets these people who are scientists or spies or doing industrial espionage or whatever it is, and then having them run up against these ancient lurking horrors that are sort of Lovecraftian horrors. So that's kind of a cool space to inhabit and a lot of fun to read.
That's awesome. I started to read a horror book, and I had to put it down, and I don't think I can finish it. So, because people know me well, and they know that I have very little, I don't know. But when they enjoy something, they want to share it. Right. I really want to give things a shot. So I was gifted Joe Hill's Heart-Shaped Box, which had been on my Amazon wish list for like a year. And I finally took it off when I had, because I didn't even know what it was about. I just knew everybody was crazy and raving about it. So I'm like, oh, everybody loves this book. I'm going to put this on my wish list. And then when I was told that, no, it was pretty scary, I'm like, oh, I better take this off my list. And as soon as I take it off, Justin, I get it. So I was a good girl, and I tried reading it, and I got like maybe 60, 70 pages in, and I'm just like, I can't, I was not sleeping.
Well, you know, that's, it's funny because that's, that's an interesting thing, you know, because it means obviously you're, in a sense, like the perfect audience, because it really becomes alive for you, right? It, you know, it does affect you that way. But of course, obviously, if it's so bad you can't sleep, that's not a great situation, right?
So, but there were a couple books that I did get through and thoroughly enjoyed this year. One is another, you know, mutual friend of ours, Chuck Wendig, who cranks out a book a day, I think, at this point. Anyway, his book Blue Blazes was one of my favorites of the year. And which is great because it has this sort of, if you're a fan of like Hellboy and BPRD, it really has that feeling to it.
Ah, interesting.
Because it, you know, what's fun is when he takes stuff and he does like set it locally. So like, you know, things will be in New Jersey or New York and, you know, but it's always like this underground, you know, place somewhere that, you know, only certain people have the sight to see. And so Blue Blazes is a drug, a street drug, you know, and lets you see the supernatural creatures that you're talking to, and they look human all the time. And it lets you see what they really are. So very trippy, but it's a mafia story. That's the heart of it, is that it's really about this organized crime story. It's just that they happen to be different types of creatures involved. And then I read Wollstonecraft by Jordan Stratford, which was a Kickstarter project.
Right.
And I know Jordan from Twitter as well, and I just found when the Kickstarter came like on my radar, it's about Mary Shelley and Ada Lovelace, but reset like the time and reset like their ages a little bit, that they would be best friends as girls.
Huh. Oh, wow. That's wild.
So like really fun, and all these other people end up making like cameo appearances and stuff in it. Really good even for young readers, because it's just a very adventurous book. You know, these two girls, you know, little girls that start a detective agency at a time when girls were not even allowed to go out of the house without a male companion. Like they couldn't just take a carriage into town without a man escorting them. So the fact that these two girls were just brazen enough to be like, well, this is what we're doing because we need to figure out who did this crime.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah,
so this is really awesome.
Yeah, there have been a few of those kind of historical reimaginings with people like Edgar Allan Poe and Charles Dickens solving crime in the last few years. That's a lot of fun, especially for people who know the time periods really well, or as a soft introduction to the historical stuff that might be otherwise fairly dry to read, you know?
Yeah. And, so I had a lot of fun reading that. I'm a pretty slow reader. So I didn't get through many books this year, but I was probably about equal with audiobooks and actually not reading novels. But what I found interesting when I was going through making my list of the audiobooks that I listened to, my favorite ones were all memoirs by women.
Interesting.
And Aisha Tyler's Self-Inflicted Wounds, Carrie Fisher's Shockaholic, and Jenny Lawson, Let's Pretend This Never Happened, who's the blog S.
Right,
which is
right.
Hilarious.
I follow her Twitter feed, and it's a scream.
Yeah. So it was one of those things where when I went back to see what did I really enjoy the most listening to, it just gave me pleasure during my drives and stuff. They were these memoirs by these women. And, you know, I don't know if it was maybe because it was sort of like if they had their own podcast for 8 hours, that's
right.
What it would be like.
yeah, absolutely. It's funny because I used to listen to just music. And unfortunately, I think listening to the audiobooks kind of takes me I kind of really need to reconnect with that as writing time, because I kind of write in my head when I'm driving if I'm listening to music. That's a lot harder to do if you're listening to somebody else's words. But
that's true. You zone out and you're not paying attention to what they're saying anyway.
Exactly. But but there are also a couple other books I just wanted to mention. There's a writer I love named Tom Drury. Tom wrote a book, it's got to be like 15, 20 years ago now, called The End of Vandalism. That was a fantastic book that was some of the chapters appear as short stories in The New Yorker. And he just wrote a sort of follow-up to that called Pacific that came out this year that has, once again, made some people's best of the year lists. And it's one of these great stories. If you love the movie Fargo, where it was a lot of the humor and fun of Fargo was just in the way people spoke to each other, people in the Northern Plains, the kind of odd way they have expressed themselves, very particular. And I think the humor in this and the humanity is very much in that same vein. These are flawed, you know, sort of gently screwed up people. One of them is a career thief named Tiny Darling. It's his ex-wife and who's married to the local sheriff. And not much happens. It's very sort of small. The way people talk to each other in this sort of odd, non sequitur-y way that people really talk, which is something I've always been fascinated by, the fact that when we're talking to each other, it seems rare to me that I'm saying something to you and you are responding fully to that. It's more, you know, I put my weird little bit out there and you put your strange little bit out there, and they're sort of like in almost like three or four different conversations going on at once, because we're not always talking to the person we're talking to. We're remembering things or responding to arguments we wish we'd won, stuff like that. And I think that's the kind of beauty of writing like Tom Drury's, is that this weird little, you know, flights of fancy that people get on. But also, like I said, a sort of deep humanity in it where he clearly loves these characters and thinks of them as real people who have a life going on somewhere in this place called Grouse County in the Northern Plains. So, you know, it's the kind of thing I really love.
That's cool. Yeah, I know what you mean, because sometimes dialogue can be tricky, especially if you're dealing with dialects. Like, how much do you put in so that it's understandable,
right.
But, you know, but yet authentic at the same time?
I think of, you know, people like Cormac McCarthy, who I love, and if you read his dialogue, it's that same kind of thing, I think, where people are, you know, they're not really talking and listening. They're kind of giving you strange little sort of advertisements for themselves, you know, putting things in these odd terms that other people don't quite get. You know, you think of those great scenes from the movie. I don't know if you ever saw No Country for Old Men.
Yeah,
right, that whole strange sequence where Javier Bardem is talking to the guy in the store, and what he's really telling them is he's going to flip this coin, and if it comes up wrong, he's going to kill the guy behind the counter. But the guy behind the counter doesn't get that at all, because you know, the way that this crazy man expresses himself is so hard to understand. He does not get the import of the conversation, and that's the kind of thing that I, like I said, I find that fascinating. Especially when you're dealing, you know, in a sort of criminal world that I am spending so much time in.
Well, I don't have bail money for you, so I don't spend too much time in the criminal world.
Well, only in, you know, online, I should say. I was worried that the FBI will begin to take an interest in the sites that I go on all day long.
Right. Isn't that a real concern now?
Oh, man. Is it ever?
I mean, the NSA is in Warcraft. So, it's like, when I'm searching up firearms, I do worry.
Exactly. Exactly.
So, any other books before we move on to other, like, music and movies?
I did want to mention, too, Joe Sacco's book. Joe Sacco is a fantastic graphic artist and writer. A lot of people know him for a book called Palestine. About the Palestinian occupation. But I've got sitting here actually a book called The Great War, which is actually not a book in the traditional sense. It is a graphic representation of the first day of the Somme, the Battle of the Somme in World War I in 1916. And it's 36 panels as one continuous sheet. So instead of, you know, having a binding, you could actually open the whole thing to be 36 feet wide. And it's a representation of, from kind of behind the scenes, the British soldiers approaching the battle to the battlefield itself, to the other sort of side of the battle where you see people taken away in ambulances and buried and all this. And it's just this incredible, richly detailed. It's the kind of thing that reminds you of, like, the people refer to the, like, the Bayeux tapestry or other things of the 18th and 19th century, this sort of very detailed battle paintings that people used to do, where they would try and represent everything that was going on these immense battlefields, to give you not just the sort of heroic aspect, but kind of tell you what went on. And that's kind of what Joe Sacco is playing with this. It's really kind of cool and fascinating, and it'd be really interesting to see this kind of thing applied to other sort of historical events, you know, or stories that you could tell in this way. It's wordless. There's no dialogue in it at all. It's just these incredibly detailed drawings that Joe did of this epic event rendered as these little tiny scenes on this gigantic tapestry.
Wow, that's really cool. I'd never heard of that before. Awesome. I will look into that. You ready to talk about some music, maybe?
Yeah, absolutely. Sure. I huge fan of a band. There's actually one guy, Phosphorescent. I don't know if you know them.
No, I don't.
There was a song that they did, Wolves, which actually showed up in a movie. I can't remember the name of the movie. It was about Wall Street. And so he began to get a little more attention, but it's this beautiful music, and he has a new album out called Muchacho de Lujo, and it's just a beautiful, beautiful kind of folky influenced, but country influenced, particular sound. I think once you hear it, you generally would recognize his music because it all sorts of falls into the same spectrum. He's done some albums that were tributes, like Willie Nelson and things like that as well. It's got this sort of beautiful, dreamy feel. This song, Wolves, my second novel is called The Wolves of Fairmount Park because I just wanted to call it Wolves because I had his song, Wolves, on a loop while I was writing.
Oh, I definitely have to check this out because I love surreal music.
No. So it's got this wonderful sort of dreamy thing. And I love to write about music. It's kind of a fun challenge because obviously you don't want to quote lyrics at length or anything like that, but to get a sense of what's going on. And in basically two of my novels, I make reference to this guy's music obliquely, because I'm listening to it all the time when I'm writing. So. Another kind of, what I do a lot is I solicit writing music suggestions. I'm always fascinated by whether people can listen to music. Do you listen to music when you write?
I do. In fact, I do the same thing. I'm like, guys, if I'm writing something set in the late 30s, give me ideas of what to put in my, Pandora. And, I take the suggestions from Twitter and start building, building up a channel just for that.
One of the things I stumbled on actually, and commercials are strangely becoming a great source of music. I don't know when that happened, but they actually...
No, that's true. Commercials and CW shows.
Yeah,
like, what is that?
Like stuff you never expected. It's really strange. But there was a movie that came out called The Comedian that, and I didn't see the movie, but the ad had this great thing called the Disintegration Loops by a guy named William Basinski. It's 4 hours long, and it's very repetitive. I don't really listen to the whole 4 hours, but sections of it, blocks of it, I'll listen to because it, once again, it sort of hits you in just that right way that I need to be that strange state to sort of put across what I want to put across when I'm writing. And that to me is really important. And I have a lot of friends who clearly inhabit that same bizarre space because I don't know that 100 people know that this disintegration loops exist, but like 10 of my writer friends do because they, you know, they're all looking for that strange, depressing, odd, you know, repetitive ambient sound.
I have to look that up. Awesome. I do, because I like trance music.
Mm. Very much so. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Anything that's sort of, like I said, sort of ambient, sort of evocative rather than, going somewhere necessarily, just kind of strange harmonies and sounds. And I listen to a fair amount of Johan Johansson, who, if people know it at all, he did a song called, which actually you had quoted the lyrics the other day, that Dorothy Parker poem, I believe.
Yeah.
Right. Well, that he turned that into a song, which was used in the ads for the movie Battle L.A. and became kind of a little cult hit based on that. It's got this very strange electronic sound, and it's just the lyrics, just the words of that poem repeated over and over again.
That is so cool.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really interesting and weird. And if you like, you know, really odd stuff, you might like it.
Awesome. I know that, let's see, some of the weird stuff that I've discovered is less weird, but like I'll make a playlist or whatever, on, like I said, on Slack or Pandora, I'll just, you know, pick by genre. So I don't know the bands, you know, and I'm not necessarily paying attention to them, but, you know, like someone came dressed as the, I guess, DJ, if you will, Deadmau5. To one of our charity events. So I was like, oh, well, what's Deadmau5? Okay, I'll go look this up. And it's, you know, that sort of Daft Punk type stuff. So just like going through samples of that one day and, you know, just discovering neat things. And I went through iTunes and I'm like, I have never heard of these. Like, I don't know the names at all.
Right.
And I just like waste a couple of hours going through and like listening to the samples.
It's always tough to find good new music. One of the things that really bugged me about the latest iteration of iTunes was it was really easy, if you clicked on something in your own playlist, to see recommendations for stuff that was like that music, which was a way I bought a lot of music, and they took that feature out. I'm not entirely clear why, because I would think they would have sold a fair amount of music, doing that. But I find it the same thing. It's very difficult. That's why I'm always asking friends and people I know will listen to my weird, dark end of the spectrum, you know, what sort of things to use, especially for writing. Alexander Sokolov is another writer. Alexander's written some great books about writing as well as, sort of mysteries and horror. And, she's also been a good source for cool, different music.
Well, what I've enjoyed as far as like singer-songwriter stuff is really, because I was already into Florence and the Machine, and then I started to get into Lana Del Rey, which is a similar sort of feeling to it, but very different subject matter.
Uh-huh.
And then I was basically just trying to find some like rockabilly stuff, and I came across Beth Hart.
Oh.
And it just like, I looked at pictures of her, and she reminded me of Krista Faust. So I'm like, oh my God, there's this like smoking hot woman with this, you know, this voice, you know, this, very, that sort of like husky lounge voice.
Yep.
And so I really started to enjoy that. I was like, oh, I never would have heard of this before. Like you said, I type in something. Amazon is okay with this too. Like if you type in something that you know, it gives you recommendations.
Right. Absolutely.
So you can.
Yeah.
So that's
and
how
I. The interesting thing about the internet generally, I think, is while the whole universe is open to you, it's not curated for you much. So trying to find good, solid recommendations for somebody who. In the way an old reliable reviewer would have once. Now you're sort of left to your own devices. And other than that, that mechanism you're talking about, if you liked this, you might like that. It can be really tough to find that stuff. You know it's out there, but, but you're struggling to connect with the things that you will really enjoy.
Right. So, yeah, I know those algorithms are there, and even Netflix has it. I mean, you build a profile.
Right.
Essentially, when you're signing up. But speaking of Netflix, right. Did you catch any really good movies this year?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There was one of the things I was really looking forward to this year was the movie Mud, which was Matthew McConaughey and Sam Shepard and these two little kids who were fantastic. Mud is a story of these little guys who live on the Mississippi River, and they stumble on an escaped convict hiding in the woods. Who's trying to reconnect with the love of his life, played by Reese Witherspoon. And Jeff Nichols is fantastic. He did a movie last year called Take Shelter, which is one of my all-time favorite movies, and also has fantastic music, by the way. Good recommendation there. I think if you like music that's sort of interesting, dark end of the spectrum. Take Shelter was Michael Shannon, who started to have dreams and became obsessed with the fact that some giant storm or apocalypse was coming that he had to protect his family against. Just an incredible, beautiful movie. And Mud was this kind of, felt almost like Huck Finn kind of space that it inhabited. But he has that great, once again, eye for detail that I love of, the guys who are chasing Mud are not just, faceless, evil people. They are people who are convinced in the rightness of what they're doing, too. And while the character played by Matthew McConaughey is a very complex character who seems a little crazy and maybe a little dangerous and doesn't always tell the truth. And, I'm a sucker for the unreliable narrator. So that was a great movie I really loved. Just saw American Hustle. I don't know if you've had a chance to see that yet.
No, I only just saw the commercial yesterday.
So good. It's so amazing. What I loved about it, in addition to the fact that it's just hysterically funny and kind of harrowing and about our area, right, takes place in Camden and Philly, is that it was driven completely by two women, Amy Adams and Jennifer Lawrence. Jennifer Lawrence is brilliant in it.
Yeah, the cast looked incredible. But, yeah, her and Bradley Cooper, right? Was it, they were teamed up?
Right.
Were they teamed? Yeah.
Just great. Just like I said, very, very funny. But the choices that they make, and you can watch them doing it because it feels largely improvised. I don't know if that's the case at all, but it has that great feel like what's going on is naturally occurring to the actors you're watching and it's got just hysterically funny and really odd. And also, once again, there's a sense of consequences. You feel for these people. In the situation that they get themselves into by trying to con everybody around them. Yeah, really, if you haven't seen it, it's definitely, I think, justly getting praised as one of the best films of the year. Also, All Is Lost, which was Robert Redford as a guy on a boat. He's, clearly like sailing around the world because he's in the Indian Ocean.
Yeah. Oh, right. Yeah. Okay. It had that very the Castaway sort of.
Yeah. I never liked Robert Redford as much as I did in this film. Just amazing. It's virtually wordless. Somebody told me the script was 30 pages long. And it's just, he wakes up on this boat, in his sailing ship, his little sailboat, and a giant container has fallen off a ship and poked a hole in his sailboat. And he's got to try and repair it, and then when it goes down, he's got to get onto a life raft and survive in this harsh environment that's just beautiful and really compelling. Excuse me.
Let's see. What did I watch this year? I didn't watch much. I've been anti-movie this year. But something that I did see that was phenomenal, in my opinion, was the movie Lovelace about Linda Lovelace, the porn actress.
Yeah, no, I'm dying to see that. It kind of came and went from the theaters really quickly, but it is a fascinating looking story. And a great cast, by the way.
Yeah, and Amanda Seyfried plays Linda Lovelace, and such a heartbreaking story. And I loved it. I love the editing. And one of my friends on Facebook said that he felt that the way that it was edited was so unnecessary because it flashes back, you see a scene play out from a certain point of view, and then you get to see what really happens. And it's about how the terrible amount of domestic abuse she went through to have this very short career in pornography, and how her husband, like, took all of the money, every single penny, like she had nothing. And, you know, eventually tries to make a new life, and she gets a book, you know, to, but the thought of going through what she went through and making a book about it and putting it out there. I mean, at that point she's got a new husband and a son, and they're going to, you know, what are they going to go through, because she's released this book about how, you know, her life in porn.
Yeah, that's exactly the kind of thing I think is fascinating about that world. I think, of course, Boogie Nights, which was kind of a fictional retelling of John Holmes' experience, and actually kind of toned down in a way. I mean, it seems like a kind of wild fantasy when you see it, but it was actually much less kind of crazy than his actual life was and the things he was connected with. And I saw a wonderful, very dark and disturbing, but a well-told story on Front Lines one time about a woman who had been in the porn world, who ended up killing herself. But it had interviews with a lot of the people from that world. And it's clearly the sort of personal stakes are so high for people in that world. You really have to either have a sort of bulletproof sense of yourself and why you're doing what you're doing. You're there to make a certain amount of money and get out, or because if you're just drifting or manipulated, as, you know, as Linda Lovelace clearly was, into that situation, you know, clearly the personal stakes are horrific. And, you know, people come through that, I think, really damaged and trying to deal with it for a long time afterward.
Yeah, it's just, and it's such an incredibly different time, because this was set in the 70s. It was about when they made the movie Deep Throat.
Right.
And, I mean, what a different time we're in now, where, you know, like, I've attended Exotica a few times, and, the you know, being, seeing what the cam girls these days go through, it's pretty different, because the majority of them, they are in business for themselves, and they are running the show.
Right.
They are in charge. And I think there's only, you know, some notable exceptions, like you're saying, where somebody else is pulling the strings, and
yeah,
you can, it almost shows, like, those girls on camera don't seem to be enjoying what they're doing.
Yeah.
Whereas girls doing it of their own free will have a whole different type of, I don't know, outlook.
Yeah. I think too, that there was a, you know, historical reality back in the 70s, you were talking about films that had to get distributed, you know,
yeah,
war tapes and things like that. And, you know, there were a lot of bad guys in that business in those days. The mob was all over porn, you know. I think they may still be to some degree, I don't know, but it doesn't require distribution, thanks to the internet, once again, the way it used to. So you could be sort of more entrepreneurial about it now than I think you could then. At some point, you needed a fair amount of money to make it all go, and the guys who had that money and would spend it in that way were not good guys. You know, so I do think the dynamics were probably very different in those days, and it was more likely that you were being, you know, exploited or victimized in some way, you know, than the possibility at least exists now, you know.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's a, we could do a whole show just on that, and maybe we will someday.
Fascinating, actually. There was a great David Foster Wallace piece about going to the sort of Academy Awards of Porn.
Like AEN?
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's pretty fascinating as well. Yeah, so that'd be great to talk about sometime.
Cool. All right, Dennis, thank you so much for your time and, you know, giving me your year review and recap.
It was a lot of fun, Ember, and looking forward, hopefully, to seeing you at the David Goodis event. And, you know, and anytime you'd like to do this again, it'd be a lot of fun.
Yeah, well, especially since you've got a book coming out in April,
yeah,
you said,
right?
Poor Boys Game. So we'll definitely have to do that. We'll get you out and promote some stuff. And but in the meantime, where can people find you so that they can keep track?
Sure. You know, go to DennisDeFoya.com is my website. And I don't have any events lined up right now. So I think basically the website and then Facebook, of course. I'll pretty much friend anybody on Facebook. And you can follow me at Dennis DeFoya on Twitter as well.
Great. So this has been part one. Guys, stay tuned. We'll be back shortly with part two of the Vodka O'Clock Year in Review. And welcome back to Vodka O'Clock, everybody. It's Amber Love back with you. And joining me now is Meredith Placco. I'm so excited to have her on the show. It's her first time here, and she does all sorts of very exciting things in pop culture and entertainment. So welcome aboard.
Thank you so much for having me, Amber. You know, this is the first time in all the years we've known each other that we've even spoken, I think.
I think, yeah, you know, I think we might have run into each other in New
York.
Very
briefly, yeah. And I was.
It was like all of 2 minutes.
Yeah, so I'm really, thank you so much for having me on. I love Vodka O'Clock. In fact, I'm about ready to break into my first vodka of the show.
Oh, good for you. So. I'm being good tonight because I did pretty well last night. Yeah. So I had quite a bit last night. I'm just going to take it easy.
Well, it's post-Vodka O'Clock for you.
It is post-Vodka O'Clock for me. I gotta get up early in the morning.
Aww.
So we are doing a year-end roundup. Let me get a little background from you. Why don't you tell everybody who you are and why we know each other and we're in the same circles.
Okay, well, I do this crazy thing called cosplay, which if you know Amber's work at all, you probably know what cosplay is. And I also tend to write a lot about cosplayers, specifically women cosplayers, and the problems that we face. Being women in costumes at conventions.
Right.
Yeah. I actually started out, I've been cosplaying since 1999. I'm old. I was old when I started and I'm continuing, but it's fine. Whatever. It just means I get to do sexy superhero characters versus sexy anime characters. And I briefly for about 7 years went by the handle Anna Aesthetic. But once my coworkers found out about my secret identity, I just kind of gave it up because I'm like, oh, whatever. They know what I do. It's not, you know, anything terrible, and they appreciate it, and I love it. And so I'm now Meredith Placco, cosplayer and supporter of women's and cosplayers' rights everywhere on the internet.
Right, because we had big things come up like cosplay does not equal consent because that was an issue, and some of the cartoonists and artists and writers this year have been having a lot of problems.
Yeah, I can't wait till we get into that because I've got some stories.
Yeah. All right. Let's not waste any time. There's always like good stories, of course, coming out of the year. There's always like great charity things to reward and favorite cosplayers that we run into here and there, favorite photographers that we get to meet and work with. But, you know, the harassment issue has been, like, probably one of the top stories to hit comics fandom this year. It really was outrageous. And it's not even just comics, because the sort of global misogyny that goes on in entertainment, like Gina Davis has spoken out about ageism, and Jim Hines, the author, does hilarious, you know, ways of bringing awareness and enlightenment to the situations that go on in the literary community. So what did you have in mind? What did you run across this year?
Well, I mean, obviously, you know, one of the biggest things that I was really fortunate to report on was 16-Bit Sirens kind of broke it with Sushi Killer, I believe, wrote the piece of Cosplay is Not Consent. And I picked it up and put it on Geeks Are Sexy based on some of my own experiences. But the great thing what 16-Bit did was they went around to conventions on the West Coast with a little white billboard and had girls and men, actually everyone pose with the cosplay does not equal consent, just to start bringing awareness that, you know, as costumers, we face this sort of, when running into fans, they kind of treat us like we're objects. And not necessarily when I say like objectifying women, though that's part of it. It's because we're dressed as these fictional characters. I feel in some people's minds, they can't remove us from that fiction. Like, you know, they think obviously they're not like a 6-year-old who thinks we're actually Wonder Woman, but they see us in these costumes and they somehow, for whatever reason, they forget that we're human beings behind these costumes. And people
right.
stop.
More like an actual prop.
Yeah, we're like a prop. And it goes from everything where people just kind of be a little weird to just outright vulgarity and physical sexual harassment. And we saw this pop up at PAX East with the Lara Croft shoot, and one of my favorite people in the world, Megan Marie, blogged extensively about that incident earlier this
year. That was one of the ones that definitely came to my mind too, because it got so much coverage.
Yeah, and as well it should, and I think it's really you know, as terrible these things are that are happening, I'm so happy that it's raising awareness, because now conventions like Dragon Con, like Anime Week in Atlanta, here in Atlanta, and other shows are now taking notice of it. And I mean, yeah, some of them are just kind of putting some, like, a sexual harassment policy in their guidebooks, but by doing that, it allows them to take stronger action, because, you know, they can say, well, we've warned these people. And, you know, well, some people, some conventions might just stop at that, like, you know, note on the page. Other conventions are taking it an extra step further and using it to really just crack down. And I think, you know, I think it's also important, though, like, while we have to sit there and say, no, this behavior is wrong, we need to bring awareness to it by not just slapping the hands of the perpetrators, but actually, you know, making people understand why this is a bad behavior.
Yeah, I would definitely agree, because well, first of all, everybody's different. Mm-hmm. So there are some men or women that are in costume that might be okay with those actions, but that's not a universal, you know, consent. Yeah. So just be aware of that. And what might be fine for one black cat might not be fine for another black cat, you know?
Yeah.
I think the character has a lot to do with it. Mm-hmm. I think people think that they can get away with more if it's an Emma Frost or a black cat or a Catwoman. Because that's been my experience anyway, that, like, Catwoman gets sluttier comments than Wonder Woman.
Yeah. But
that's just my own experience.
But then I think about it, and I don't want to name anyone, just because I don't want to, like, perpetuate a problem, but I know a Wonder Woman that there is a Flickr account dedicated to her butt, and there's people who go and take pictures of this poor girl's butt, and it's like,
I've seen that for Ms. Marvel. There's a Ms. Marvel butt gallery.
Yeah, and I'm just like, guys, why do you think this is okay? I mean, but of course, it's probably no different than the guy that walks around Walmart with, like, the, you know, flash cam on his cane taking upskirt shots. I mean, there's always going to be creepers out there, but for some reason, I kind of worry that our subculture attracts some of the extra creepy guys.
Yeah. And but like you said, there are conventions that are finally taking the steps that hadn't been discussed before. And that's a really good thing. I know, like, the Mary Sue website was keeping a list, and every once in a while they'll update with conventions that have you know, either added policies or have new announcements, anything like that.
Yeah,
and it's helpful.
I think in turn we need to have a list of conventions that contribute to the problem. I was not there, but I heard about a con out on the West Coast, in the Northwest area, that there was a DJ that they hired who had a prior like,
he has a sex offender record.
Yeah, it was a registered sex offender, and there was some, you know, incidents of impropriety going on there with an underage girl. And I'm like, you guys got to be aware. And people have contacted the convention ahead of time, and they did nothing. And I'm like,
no, they said that it's a police matter, and they keep hiring the guy year after year as the DJ.
Yeah, I'm like,
and just say it's a police matter. I'm like, well, then you're a shitty con.
Yeah, like, you're kind of a shitty person, and I hope, you know, people stop going to your convention.
Yeah, I believe it was AkiCon.
Yeah.
AkiCon. Yeah. And because I remember when a friend of mine told me about that, I was just livid. I'm like, I'm like, how deep does this go? And then I started finding other people's YouTube videos about the accusations and stuff. And you start digging into it, and it just kept going. And, like, because criminal records are public record, you could just look up this guy's information and see all the charges against him and see what he had. And they weren't just charged, like, he did time.
Yeah, he was in jail. Like, I just don't understand how people think that they can just dismiss it. But I guess it's part of that, like, out of sight, out of mind mentality. Which unfortunately, you know, it's funny that we're talking about this, because I'm actually about ready to publish one of my, I want to say it's probably one of my best pieces I've ever written, kind of on a similar matter that deals with the whole, you know, not just cosplay is not consent, but just the way that a lot of, you know, us in the subculture and in general, how we will turn our blinders on when it suits us, in terms of, you know, people we respect. And I actually cite the, you know, we're going to have to talk about it, the Tess Fowler and Brian Wood incident.
Yeah, exactly.
Because
some you get to the point where it's like, oh, but I'm a really big fan of his work.
Yeah.
Do I, you know, what do I do?
It is. It's really hard. And, you know, when I was first, my friends first alerted me to the Tess and Wood thing. Some, everyone knows, like, DMZ is my jam. I mean, it's about a fucking reporter. I mean, how could I not, like, love that story? Reporter in New York City, no less. In wartime, but, you know, and at first I was super dismissive. I'm like, this happened 8 years ago. Like, why is she bringing it up now? What does she hope to gain? And I was like that for a good month and a half. And then, you know, I'm sitting there Christmas morning, like, ironing something, and it hits me. And I started thinking about something that happened to me last year and something, you know, that had happened to me 3 years ago. And I was like, wow, I'm like, I just did to test what a group of people did to me when I came out about my abuse. And I dismissed her because I didn't want to believe something about a person. Now, and I you know, on the Brian Wood situation, he's come out, he's apologized. There is something to be said that behavior has happened in the past. So I want to believe that he can change. And it's not like he, you know, forcibly held down a girl and you know, did anything terrible to her. I mean, he just kind of acted like a, you know, a bro, a D-bag, you know, he.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
He just kind of pushed a couple of girls into awkward situations, but as far as I know, he never crossed, like, a physical line. And, you know, again, maybe this is me still trying to justify it, but I do like to believe that, you know, certain people have the capacity to change in the right mindset. But, yeah, I totally did to Tess and those women what I'd been done to me, and I was just like, wow, that's really shitty of me, and it caused me to really reevaluate the whole situation.
That's great. So that piece is going to go up on Geeks Are Sexy.
Actually, I have an agent for my reporting, and she's actually shopping it at a magazine. So
okay.
There's a.
So we'll keep our eye.
Yeah, I'll announce it when I can. But there's two major publications that it might actually go up in. So I'm really excited because it'll be my first, like, real printed piece too, of volume. So.
Okay. Great. I know that one of the more recent issues that came up was on a cartoonist panel that was supposed to be about diversity and embracing our differences. And it was talking about LGBT themes in comics. And Mari Naomi, I believe her name is, underwent some ridiculous douche bro comments from a fellow panelist.
Oh, yeah. I heard about that. I only recently heard about this. And
I think it was on The Beat. I think it was might have been Comics Beat.
Yeah. Is this not my favorite DC Comics guy of all time?
Scott Lobdell.
Oh, Scott. You keep, please keep putting your foot in the mouth because I make my money writing off of your dumb shit.
Yeah. I mean, well, let's face it. You know, anybody who's known for writing Starfire, you know, as such a vapid sex object. He was the panelist chosen to talk about, you know, bisexuality or something in comics. Like, are you serious?
I'm like, but no, I mean, writing about a woman character having sex with whatever she wants because she can't remember afterwards, that doesn't make you an expert on bisexuality. That just makes you a terrible dude bro who fantasizes about women banging each other.
Yeah. So, I mean, just the sheer fact that he was on the panel and then the stupid comments that he made, and he issued an apology, but it came across apparently after the panel, he apologized to the artist's husband, not to her.
Is she the property of her husband? Is this how we're
yes.
supposed to treat women?
Yeah. So it was like, I'm really sorry I put your wife in that position. Like, are you kidding? No. Just take, you know, so yeah. So whatever. And then at a certain point, a written apology was issued and, you know, hey, good for him. But
yeah, but it, you know, it's hard. It's so hard to take some of these apologies sincerely because it's like the pressure's on you. What are you supposed to do if you don't apologize? You look like you're even more of the problem.
Right. But when it comes to our lives in cosplay, we do have really good positive moments. Like I said, we do. There's charity work and then there's fun events and gatherings, get togethers at all the conventions. And so this year I was very grateful that I finally got to do – I did a lot less cosplay, mm-hmm. but when I actually did take the time for it, I got to do something I never had done before. So I got to go, first of all, to Virginia mm-hmm. Comic-Con, where I had never been to that show before. Mm-hmm. And I was tagging along with Jim Kohorek from the book Dead Irons, and – he got a special effects makeup artist to work on me and another cosplayer. So I got to spend 3 hours in the chair getting professional makeup done. and it was unbelievable. And then we went and shot on green screen, which I had also never done.
Oh my God.
I got like three things I had never done before, all in one.
It's like cosplay bucket list right there.
It really was. It was so much fun, and it was such a different kind of photo shoot than what I'm used to. Like if I'm in a studio or outside or something, I'm used to where you crank off like a couple hundred pictures, you know, to get a few that you know are going to be usable. This was like every shot had to count, and like I kept sticking out my elbow or I'd be looking or I'd be blinking. And, it was just one of those things where I just felt like every single time the guy clicked his camera, he had to correct me on something. I'm like, oh my God, the guy that I was working with, who was the other costumer, I'm like, he must just think I'm an idiot. Like, I take pictures all the time, and I'm getting corrected on every single shot here.
It's just such a different environment, because I had that happen to me. I had my bucket list cosplay photographer moment this year, too, and I was like, I'm not worthy. I'm not good enough. Oh, my God, I'm fucking everything up.
So who did you get to work with?
Well, I went out to San Diego Comic-Con a week early and had the chance to shoot with Filipino photographer Jay Tablante.
Okay.
Who, if you guys aren't familiar with his work, Google Jay Tablante, but he's done some of the best Marvel characters ever. Like,
plus, you know Pat Wicker.
Yeah, I know Pat. That's how I got in. Let's just be honest. I mean,
so like, you very Pat already shoots like everything.
Yeah, but Pat helped me get in, and I got to work with Vampy Linda Lee, who is like my cosplay darling. I was so intimidated and so nervous working with her because she's just been kind of my idol for so many years, and she was the sweetest thing. And I'm really excited, like, you know, we bonded over, you know, our experience, and I also got to meet Hikaru Jan, who's another great West Coaster, and it was just so fun getting to, like, you know, work with girls who are used to kind of working with more professional photographers. And, you know, having that experience of a day of like, wow, this is what a real model feels like. And it was awesome when we shot like my Psylocke and Tomb Raider, Lara Croft and Emma Frost. And, you know, Jay has like this team back in the Philippines that like edits these photos. Like, they're super like, you know, polished. And so like only my Lara Croft has come out. But
I was going to say the Lara Croft looked like, I know they did as much as they could to match it to the video.
Yeah,
game.
I was like shocked. And I was like, and I've seen a lot of, and like I'm really fortunate that I get to see kind of the before and how, what he corrects. And it's like, in terms of like body modification correcting, Jay doesn't do a whole lot of that because he gets his lights set up, and so much of the sculpting and the toning is done just with his physical lights. Like, you know, I thought, I was like, man, like, you photoshopped the hell, and he showed me the original photo. I was like, no, this is all just in lighting. So like, he's like, yeah, I tucked a little here and lifted a little there, but nothing minor, nothing I wouldn't have done myself. So I was just like, that was also something that was really nice, because I'm like, wow, this is how this person sees me.
Yeah, that's really great, because, I mean, I know they just made the rounds about how, like, Jennifer Lawrence's cover on one of the magazines was just, you know, so over-photoshopped, and it's like, people, it's not just her.
Yeah.
This is every magazine everywhere.
Yeah, it really is, and it's like, and I will say, you know, looking at some of the before and after stuff that I've been able to see, you know, a lot of it really is just his lighting is, you know, when you're in a controlled studio setting and you've got access to four or five lights, that makes a difference on a person. Like, it really does.
Yeah, I think so.
So yeah, so that was my happy experience, and that's also my my photographer shout out of the year.
That's fantastic. You know, but thinking about some of the charity work that we do, because I help organize Superhero Weekend over here in New Jersey, and one of my favorite charity moments this year was, always whenever I work with the 501st, mm-hmm. because I'm not part of them, but whenever I get to hang out with those guys, I just worship them. But singer Sarah Donner came over to the shop, and she is just delightful.
Aww.
She is a nerd singer from New York, and she also fosters kittens and finds home for them. So I'm like, this woman is just completely remarkable. And, again, people got me hooked up with her through Twitter.
Nice.
To introduce me to her work. So that was just like a nice, memorable charity moment for the year, because not only was it about Superhero Weekend, but something very specific about it that made it special this year.
Yeah, I actually have to say my charity moment was actually really selfish. I found myself in a position where one of my cats had a collapsed lung and was really not doing well, and he needed about $3,000 in surgery to help him live. And I mean, he's an older cat, he's 12. And I was in between, I'm a freelance news producer, and some months I'm like making it rain, and some months it just was exceptionally dry at the beginning of summer. And I had some friends who convinced me to run a GoFundMe, which I've never asked for money in my entire life. And people came, people I've never known, came and donated far and wide for this derpy cat. And he's sitting here. If you hear weird noises, it's because Angel's sitting here with me. And I just want to say, like, you know, anyone who listened to this and donated and helped Angel's fund this year, like, thank you guys. You know, you made my year, because I love my cat. Oh, I'm crying. I love my cat so much.
I know. I know the feeling. Yeah. I know. I sold a bunch of costumes to pay a vet bill.
Yeah.
So I know.
Our cats are our babies. So and anyone who was able to give even just a little bit and, you know, maybe not necessarily money, but time and to any charity, you know, that's great. And the one thing I was able to do before the year ended, around Christmas, I had a couple hundred extra. And I went to my local pet rescue, and I gave 300 to them, and I said, the next three people who adopt cats, tell them it someone already paid for it. And
that's fantastic.
Yeah, and I was hoping that because doing that, the people would still donate the adoption fee, and two of the three people did donate the adoption fee back into the charity. So that made me really happy. So I'm glad I was able to give back a little bit.
Yeah, I just love those heartwarming ones. I know our costume friend, Han Pan.
Oh, yeah, I love Han Pan.
Hannah's just did the same thing. Yeah. She just went through like her own little fundraiser because her cat was having so many medical issues as well. And she was calculating out, like, she's cooking his own food, like cooking and going through like all this organic process to make, like, she, well, first of all, she's in the kitchen all the time.
Yeah.
So she was like working out the very precise recipes and stuff, and like really doing a ton of research on food in order to get something that the cat would be able to eat and digest properly and stuff. And she was calculating like it's $100 a week or something in people food to prepare for the cat. You know,
what we do for our animals.
Yeah. So it's crazy stuff, but she, you know, she runs an Etsy shop too, in order to try and pay those vet bills. Well, let's talk about publishers and bloggers. They're sort of like, sometimes it's the same thing, but publisher, if you want to talk about favorite comics this year, what kind of stuff has been turning you on this year?
Man, I've been like super indie, I guess, this year. Creator owned.
Oh, me too.
You say creator owned. I really got into Saga finally. Got that, and I'm really excited. East of West, I think, is my comic of the year is East of West. Absolutely great story about death and the coming of the apocalypse. And if you like really kind of sci-fi westerns, this is the comic for you. And then other than that, you know, hate to say it, but I'm really enjoying All New X-Men. Brian Wood, you're doing a good job writing an all-woman cast. Keep that up, please.
Oh, boy, the irony.
I know. Oh yeah, no. X-Men itself has been phenomenal, but I'm an X-lady through and through. My first comic was an X-Men comic, and my last comic will probably be an X-Men comic.
Right. Yeah, that's something that has always been very evident in your fandoms.
Yeah.
I've been completely indie as well this year. I think I read one mainstream DC book, and it wasn't even current in the sense that it came out through DC. It was actually a reprint from the UK, so it was out through Titan Comics, and it was the only Batman Superman book that I read.
Yeah.
But otherwise, I've been really enjoying a lot of indie stuff. Like, there's a pulp book called Jack Hammer from Action Lab by Brandon Barrows, and I believe the artist's name is Ionic, I think he goes by. Mm. Red Chambers by Wes Loker, and he had a pretty big team, Christian Rossi, Kefas Armando and Amanda Kent, Imagine Agents by Brian Joins, and again, I don't know how to pronounce this guy's last name, Bakken, I think is what he goes by, and just a ton of other things. Lone Ranger, first of all, is always, you know, top of my list, along with My Little Pony. I mean, those are the most mainstream things that I read. Some smaller press things through Monkey Brain Comics, Amelia Cole and Strange Nation.
I've heard really good things about that.
Yeah. So, you know, shout out to those guys. They do great work there. Amelia Cole, I met the, it's a, let's see, DJ Kirkbride, I can't remember Broken Shore's first name, and Adam Nave. Mm-hmm. Again, guys that I, you know, met on Twitter. So I, you know, ran into them at Comic-Con. And Strange Nation is by Paul Aller and Juan Romero. And Paul's a good friend of mine. So I remember, you know, like I've read Paul's scripts before even seeing the work come out. But he always does really cool stories. And this is actually not a surprise, but it's like so sci-fi and basically like taking urban legends, like, you know, Bigfoot stories and stuff like that, and working it that this reporter worked for a tabloid that covered these stories and they actually were true.
Oh, that sounds awesome.
So it's really fun, and it's on Comixology. Oh. I think the third issue it just came out. A lot of fun. Yeah, a lot of fun things in the indie world.
Yeah. In things I never thought I'd ever say, I have a Comixology account. I also have a Kindle account on my iPad. Earlier this year, I was like, never ever going to switch to digital. Blah, 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 blah. I need real books. Oh, my God. I don't have space for books. Oh, my God. It's so much more convenient to keep it on my iPad.
Yeah, it really is. Oh, but I don't want to forget to mention Death Sentence, which is actually probably my favorite book of the year.
Who does that?
Monty Nero and Mike Dowling, and that's from Titan Comics. And it's about people who get a sexually transmitted disease called the G-plus virus.
Mm-hmm.
So if you get it, you get special abilities, but you only get 6 months to live.
Oh. Yeah.
So,
you're going to be my go-to indie girl. Like, you know all the interesting sounding ones.
I get like the weirdest stuff and you know, and then I just end up loving it. So, and a lot of the things with the indie publishers is they're so responsive. When I write to them and just go, hey, I somehow missed the FTP for issue 2, mm-hmm. but I'm up to, you know, but I have issues 1 and 3. Can you send me 2 again? And it's like within minutes, I'll have issue 2 in my inbox. They're just, you know, I love that. That's like Action Lab, Titan, New Paradigm Studios, they're just like so responsive. I love, you know, just the interaction that I get from those creators and the publishers as well. But in Death Sentence, what's cool is there's like 3 main characters. There's a chick who's very punk rock sort of style, and she's an artist. Mm-hmm. And then there's a comedian who looks and sounds basically drawn a lot like Russell Brand,
mm-hmm.
but vulgar, very, very vulgar. And then there's a guy who's like the lead singer of a rock band, and they're the ones who have the virus that we know of. So it's following their story.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and I know that they just landed on somebody else's number one spot for like favorite book of the year, too. So Death Sentence, everybody, really is taking off. But I don't know if I could pick a favorite publisher because, like I said, it seemed like every indie publisher came out with something awesome.
Yeah, I'm so bad about just kind of knowing who does what. Like you would think that I would like pay attention, but like I couldn't even like I'm blanking on even who did East of West because I have no memory. I literally have.
Yeah,
no memory.
I had to make a spreadsheet. Because I was like, I had to go back and like research who the names were because I couldn't remember.
Yeah. Like I should, you know, if I wasn't work for 10 hours, I would have done a little bit more research. I do want to say, one other thing that I got to read this year, thanks to Jay, was he brought over some comics from the Philippines. And I read, this one called Trace. That you can get it on Amazon, digital download, translated in English. And it deals with, a bunch of underworld, like bad guys also mixed with like the supernatural. So a lot of the stories also deal with like Filipino urban legends and like their history and like all like the bad juju that happens. And the main character, Alexandra Trace, you know, is kind of like her whole thing is to kind of stop the underworld crime and also the evil spirits from taking over Manila and the Philippines. And it's a really phenomenal, couple of books. I read 2 of the trades and they're really great. So,
And that's, is it T-R-A-C-E?
T-R-E-S-E. Trace, like Trace?
Gotcha.
Yeah, really, really awesome. It first came out in 2005, ended in 2011, 17 issue, like single issues to date. And really, really awesome. I was like, it was really nice to kind of look and read, you know, other countries' comic books. I mean, I read a lot of French comics, but, you know, and obviously Japanese manga I used to read, but, you know, I never knew about the Filipino comic scene.
Yeah, I hadn't really specifically heard anybody talk about that, because I hear people talk about French and Italian mm-hmm. books more often.
Yeah, and there's even, like, one of the things that's even popped up, and it popped up, I think, on Huffington Post, but, you know, I also heard from Jay, they have a transgendered superhero who, like, was, like, one of the top, like, 100 hottest super, like, top 100 hottest women in like, Philippine Maxim or something like that, and she's fictional, but it starts off, the comic is, he's, like, a hairdresser by day, but then he can transform into this really awesome Wonder Woman-esque character by night, and it's Zaza, like, Zaza Gabor.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. I hadn't heard of that.
Yeah, so I'm like, this is awesome. I'm like, and I want to go, like, next year I want to make a big point to read other, like, countries' comics.
That's a good goal.
Yeah.
I would say that's definitely a good fan goal to have. Do you have any favorite blogs that are always, you know, things that you must visit, or you find, you know, that you particularly retweet and share a lot of?
Yeah, actually, it's funny. I became aware of her blog after she roomed with me at New York or at San Diego Comic Con. A friend of my roommate's, Marlene, she runs a blog called I Like Comics Too. And she's really awesome. She does a lot of pro women blogging. In fact, you know, a gift set of her got around Tumblr recently about her kind of going off on people being D-bags about cosplayers. And she did a panel at San Diego Comic Con. And I don't think she may have also done the New York one, but it was the people of color in comics. Because she's, you know, of not white descent, and she's really awesome, and she writes, you know, and not everything she writes, though, and that's what I like about her, not everything she writes is charged behind being, you know, not white and being a woman. She just writes really good stuff. She blogs really good stuff. She's a huge comic book nerd. She did a really awesome Blue Beetle costume, so she's also a cosplayer, and she interned for Marvel, so I just really love, like, just her views and general, she tends to just be really awesome. So I'm always reading her stuff, and you can go to ilikecomics2.com or follow her on Tumblr.
That's cool. I'm pretty sure I follow her as well.
Yeah, she's
my favorite blogs are always so diverse, not necessarily ever having anything to do with comics,
yeah.
But Chuck Wendig writes at Terrible Minds. That's his website. Mm-hmm. He's a very prolific author, and he always gives amazing writing advice, but every once in a while, he'll also sprinkle in other just random things. Like, he likes to talk about cooking, and he likes to talk about beers, and he likes to talk about raising a toddler right now. Terrible Minds always has incredible advice columns. Mm. The Blog Ass is phenomenal, because I crack up by her stories, because I'll end up sending them out and going, I swear to God, this is a conversation we would have, you know, because it's always her and her husband bantering back and forth, and she just, you know, it's hilarious. Comics related stuff, though, Joe Sergi occasionally writes for the Legal Defense Fund, which is cbldf.org, and he uncovers things that require a vast amount of research. But which is why there aren't articles, like, regularly, because so much gets put into these things.
Yeah.
Interesting cases about how comics have been condemned through our years, charges brought up, and comic shops being raided, and people going to jail, and stuff like that. So you can always check over at that CBLDF website for their blog updates. And one of my favorites, just for the fun of it, because I do like things that lean towards the pulp and mm-hmm. noir side, is Topless Pulp. Their blog is coedtoplesspulpfiction.wordpress.com. And this is a group of folks from New York City that meet because it's legal to be topless in New York City. So they'll meet in Central Park, and they will read topless, or they'll be on a rooftop. And, you know, and it's interesting because Go Topless Day is in August. So they're two completely different organizations, but things that cross my path. And I'm like, well, I'm in New Jersey. We're not allowed to be topless here except in designated spots. so one of these days I just discovered that there is a clothing optional park somewhere near me. I have no idea where it is, but I found their website.
Nice.
And it's seasonal. So maybe in the summer months,
yeah,
I'll be able to go partake with other people and go read out without being encumbered by clothing.
Well, I'm like, I don't think you want to do that in January.
I'm like, no.
Maybe a little cold. Maybe.
I don't know how they do it. I've seen girls that do crazy, either fully nude or bikini shots or whatever in the snow, and it's really cold. I tried last year and I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
I was like, no, this is too uncomfortable.
Well, if we're talking non-geek blogs, I do have to give a shout out to two of my, like, I check every day.
Yeah.
Korea Indie, which is all about Korean rock, pop, and rap music, and it's all indie labels and indie artists. So it's stuff that, like, if you're into, like, the popular K-pop bands, these are the people who totally fly under your radar. It's basically Korean hipster music. Yes, I'm that hipster that I listen to Korean hipster music. No, it's just a really great blog that not only gives a look into the music coming out, but just some of the lifestyle behind the musicians, which I, you know, love knowing about the people who create this music. And then since I'm a big cook, I discovered thekitchenpaper.com, which is a lot of really good, like, sweets and DIY, and she even has a sports section. But she's got this ballin' Oreo cookie butter recipe. That's all I need to say. Oreo cookie butter. It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's so good.
That sounds
my favorites.
All right. Anything else that you want to share? Anything that you're looking forward to in the new year, perhaps?
Well, moving to LA.
That's true.
Yeah.
You've got a big changes coming.
Big and nerve-wracking, and I have to pack up my house and 5 cats and move across the country, and I don't know what the fuck I'm doing. So I'm looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to more costumes and conventions, and I'm really looking forward to getting to know the West Coast scene. I've only gotten to do San Diego, and now I'll get to do other shows, and I'm excited to kind of see what you know, I always hear, you know, back in the day, it was always like, you know, East Coast versus West Coast rappers. And I hear East Coast versus West Coast cosplayers. So
I know. It's funny how that happens.
How this is going to play out.
Yeah, I definitely would like to get to new conventions. I want to get to different conventions, not necessarily more,
yeah,
but just see some different towns and meet some different people. I will probably do less cosplay because if I'm traveling, I just don't know how people pack. I look at, like, DJ Spider's van that she packs for Dragon Con, and not only does she have all of her DJ equipment, but she has all of her costumes in there, and I'm like, I just don't want to deal with that. If it's more than two small carry-on size things.
Yeah, it has to be a lot.
Yeah, it is an awful lot. So the least amount that I have to pack, the better. So I'm not sure exactly what's slated for me, but I do want to see some new things.
Yeah. Also, Winter Soldier. That's, like, all I care about next year.
Oh, okay.
I'm really excited. So Captain America Winter Soldier in my household is a favorite. My roommate is a huge Bucky fan, and through her I've come to love and adore Bucky, and I feel like the Winter Soldier movie is going to be one of the best Marvel movies for me to date. I'm not going to say it's the best
one
because I don't want to impose my feelings on other people's, but I'm super excited.
Yeah, the little bit that's been seen looks amazing.
And Guardians looks cool too, I guess.
I know. How can anybody, you know, like, not love Rocket Raccoon?
I know. I was like, what? They're doing a movie with a talking raccoon? What the hell? And I'm like, oh, wait.
With a giant gun. Yes.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. That'll be great. That'll definitely be great. All right, Meredith, where can people find you so that they can follow along with your transition over to the West Side?
Well, you can find me at MeredithPlacco.com. That's MeredithPlacko. On Twitter, you can read my thoughts in 140 characters or less at Twitter.com/MPlacco. And if you want to look at my cosplay stuff, you can still find that on Facebook.com/AnnaAesthetic, because I'll put you to sleep with how boring my costumes are, because I'm not sexy.
No, that's not true.
I'm sassy. By the way, fair warning, if you follow me anywhere and you interact with me and I sass you, it's out of love. It's just out of love.
This is fantastic. Well, hopefully we will cross paths. I don't know. I don't know if you head out that way, if you're ever going to come back.
I'll be at New York for sure next.
Okay. Yeah. All right. We'll have to definitely cross paths then.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for coming on board. All right, guys. Stay tuned, and we will do a wrap-up for Vodka Clocks Year in Review.
Okay, everyone, it's Amber Love back with you for the wrap-up of the wrap-up, if you will. I didn't get a chance to cover absolutely everything with my guests, Dennis DeFoya and Meredith Placco, so I just wanted to say thank you for listening to the show for the entire year. This makes 42 episodes out in 2013. I wanted to remind you about some of my favorite graphic novels that hit the shelves in 2013. March Book One by, of course, John Lewis, with art by Andrew Aiden and Nate Powell. And I've only just started reading it, so I haven't actually finished it yet, but I'm counting it as a 2013 book. And Capote in Kansas was re-released by Oni Press, and that's by Andy Parks with amazing art by Chris Somney. And it's about the Truman Capote story and how he was writing in cold blood, which is something I didn't know anything about. So I went into that book completely cold, and I really enjoyed it. It's has some slightly graphic notions to it because it is about him researching these murders, but nothing like Green River Killer, not quite at that level. So I just think that you should go get that because the reprint has some cool stuff in it, some extras added. And Marbles by Ellen Forney was just absolutely fantastic. It's about dealing with manic depression and bipolar disorder, and it's just a really, really remarkable memoir. So I highly recommend that. I always have since the second I put it down. And let's see. So who should be on your list for people to keep an eye on for 2014? Definitely Paul Aller, as you heard me telling Meredith Placco about Strange Nation. Paul is a friend of mine, and he's really, really great with not only getting his own stuff out, but he's a great editor, and he does a lot of work for Comics Experience, where we met. So if you're interested in making comics, check out Comics Experience. And let's see, I think you're pretty familiar with any of the other names I can mention, like Sean Aldridge, Phil Sloan, and Eric Grissom, and Jenny Wood. Of course, hopefully we'll have Jenny back on the show for 2014, and Eric Grissom is already slated to come back on the show. So these are names that you will definitely see in my tweets in the future. And thank you again for listening. Don't forget, you can follow me on Twitter at Elizabeth Amber. That's where I do spend the most time. And the website is amberunmasked.com. If you have any feedback, you can leave that, I believe, on Stitcher as well. And, of course, on iTunes, they do the ratings thing. I don't know that it really matters. Feel free to just leave your comments on my show notes at amberunmasked.com because I read those instantly. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Have a wonderful and safe New Year.